Hi everyone, so it's now hit 2 o'clock and we will now begin the session. So first and foremost, good afternoon, a very warm welcome to all of you who are tuning in today to Art Puns to This Space as we host our forum regarding drug usage and the death penalty in Malaysia. My name is Michelle and I will be the moderator for today's session. And for all of us, all of you that are joining us for the first time today and aren't too clear on who we are, ATPAN, which is short for the Anti-Death Penalty Asian Network, is a regional network of organizations and individuals committed to working towards the abolition of the death penalty in the Asia-Pacific region. So to basically just give some context behind today's forum, it's pretty well known that Malaysia has had the death penalty since its colonial era days and is currently being retained for 12 offenses. According to some research that we did in the last few months, shockingly enough, as of 1 September 2021, 68% of those on death row are being convicted for drug offences. And thankfully, no executions have taken place since 2018 because of a moratorium that was imposed by the Pakatan Harapan government. So it is one of our objectives for today's forum really is to just discuss all things related to the death penalty and drug use in Malaysia, which obviously includes highlighting key cases and maybe discussing public perception and definitely relating to some cases that have occurred in the last few years. How I will be doing this will be basically asking a few questions regarding a very brief overview of the death penalty first and foremost, followed by a general discussion on drugs, and last but not least, the deterrence factor, whether the death penalty really is working to deter future offences. It brings me a great pleasure to have Professor Vignesingam with us today to be able to discuss all of these matters with us. And for those of you who don't know who he is, Professor Vigna is basically a professor of addictions at the Centre for Drug Research at University Science Malaysia and was a director from 2017 to 2021. His research area right now currently focuses on the understanding and development of behavioral interventions for drug users. He's currently a member of the Scientific Advisory Committee of the World Drug Report at the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crimes, and he's also an associate editor for Emerging Trends in Novel Psychoactive Substances and the Health Consequences Journal. He has published extensively in scholarly journals and has presented scientific papers in numerous international conferences. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome Professor Vigna to the floor. Hi, Professor Vigna. Can you hear us?
Yes.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah. We can hear you. Okay. So just to give maybe a very basic starter questions, I guess one of the first things I'd like to ask is, you know, how is the concept of a dangerous drug formulated? You know, we've seen the progress of cannabis over the years. You know, previously it was a dangerous drug, but, you know, as we see more growing international acceptance of it. So, yeah, how is this formulated?
Okay, the how the classification of a dangerous drugs is actually, they're classified by the United Nations, where there's what we call drug scheduling that takes place at the UN. So this happens at the Commission for Narcotics Drugs, and the International Narcotics Control Board, INCB, are two agencies of the United Nations that actually are involved in determining this. At the same time, there is the World Health Organization also classifies drug dependence. So the classification basically comes from the United Nations, the CND, Commission for Narcotics Drug, and the INCB. Mm-hmm. And Malaysia being a signatory, our government, they have their yearly meetings and they would review which drug that needs to be scheduled. So these are most of the time these dangerous drugs are Schedule 1 drugs. So these are the scheduling procedures that take place, which they deemed as dangerous, harmful, harmful to health. Mm. So this is what the classification, and Malaysia normally adopts this classification of drugs. Mm. So this is how the classification actually takes place.
Nice.
Right.
Thank you so much for breaking it down for all of us. That's actually really interesting to know that, you know, Malaysia actually does follow in par with all of these international conventions. I guess my next question for you is, you know, are drug issues, you know, incredibly prominent in Malaysia compared to other countries, you know, because on a daily basis, we're seeing in news articles, you know, maybe there are drug trafficking syndicates that are going around, or maybe there's increased drug usage among certain groups. You know, how incredibly prominent is this issue here?
I think there's not a single country in the world that we can say that hasn't got a drug problem. But being geographically placed in Southeast Asia, being in close proximity to the Golden Triangle, Malaysia has always been seen as one of the countries that how drug is moved or drug is trafficked through. You know, it's a trafficking route to Australia through Southeast Asia from the Golden Triangle. There are also trafficking routes that come in from East Asia, from China, for example, that passes through Malaysia to go to other parts of the world. So while it is also a transit hub for trafficking drugs, drug use is also relatively high in the country. But I would say, like, you know, we're not exceptionally high. We are, you know, like any other country in the world. It may seem exceptionally high because we enforce the laws. Not many countries arrest drug users. We actually, if you look at the arrest data, I was looking at the arrest data of crime in Penang. The police would report arrest for crime, but if you really look break down that data, almost 70 to 80% of their daily arrests. In fact, I would say about 80% of their daily arrests are all drug offences. And they're not really traffickers, but they're all users. So we enforce the law very strictly here for drug users, not only for drug traffickers. Yeah, so that's why you see that, you know, it seems like there's a lot of arrests for drug-related offences in Malaysia.
I see. I guess for the benefit of those of us who aren't really too clear about all this terminology, do you think you could break it down and tell us what the Golden Triangle is?
Okay, the Golden Triangle is, you know, there are several drug-producing hubs in the world. The Golden Triangle is one of them. And then you have got the Golden Crescent, which is the Afghanistan-Iran, that side. And then the Golden Triangle are basically countries, Thailand, Laos, Myanmar, they're major drug-producing countries. And then you have got in one in Latin America as well that produces cocaine in Colombia and so on. So these are like the three major drug-producing. But these are all plant-based drugs. Then, of course, you have synthetic drugs which are produced in laboratories and so on. So, yeah, the Golden Triangle. So, Thailand, Laos, Myanmar, to answer your question, is very close to us. And drugs come down towards Peninsula Malaysia and it's used as a transit point to move drugs to Europe, to move to Australia and so on.
I see. So, basically, the Golden Triangle is it kind of impacts areas in Southeast Asia, I think it's safe to assume.
Yes.
I see. Okay. Thank you so much for breaking that down for us. Okay. My third question is, you know, we've seen the history of drug offences in Malaysia. And in 1975, you know, the death penalty was a discretionary element. I guess my question is, you know, why was it introduced mandatorily in 1983 after that? You know, was it really seen to be an effective deterrent then to kind of prevent all of these drug activity from occurring?
Yeah, I think in 1983, it was made mandatory, and also in 1983, the government, I think that time by Tun Mahathir, came up very strongly. I think there was even a slogan to say, "Das Dada Moso Number Satu Negara," or number one enemy in the country. And this largely was, it's not only Malaysia, this is a system that was created actually at the UN. Because drug use was seen at that time as a social problem, as a security threat to the country. That is why you see that in most countries, drug use is actually placed under the Ministry of Home Affairs. Right? So, but over the years, I mean, this, and this was, you know, if you look at even America in the 70s, Nixon's, you know, going tough on drugs.
Yes.
And if you study drug policy, you would see that the international systems on going tough with drugs did not work. And Malaysia, you know, like many other countries in the world, followed that because the intent of the policy was seen more to be more important than the outcome of the policy. And that's, you know, the intent, which means exactly what we're doing until today in Malaysia. We are looking at the outputs. You know, you come up with very harsh laws, and therefore you show that, you know, you have arrested so many drug traffickers, so many drug users, so many thousands of them. But no one is looking at the outcomes or the impact of what you have done. So, because this has created a whole range of problems where the outcome is seen as very important, but no one talks. Sorry, the output is seen as something that is very important, but the outcome is not measured at all. So the when you look at output, and you know, when you treat this as a social problem, as a security problem, society also has got is made to understand that this is a social and security problem. But we now, in the, you know, in the last 20, 30 years, we have got more medical evidence to show that drug use, you know, persistent or continuous drug use actually damages your brains. So now there is a move to now try to understand drug use from a health perspective. But it is, this transition has been slow, and, you know, there has been, if you read the literature, there has been severe criticisms of the international drug conventions because the intent of the policy of showing that how hard you can go has simply not shown any good results. So the outputs are good, but the outcomes are bad. So how do we now move this understanding towards to make people understand that drug use is actually has got its health consequences? And I think somewhere in the 90s and year 2000s, the HIV epidemics hit drug users very badly. You know, many drug users died because of the HIV epidemic. And I think Malaysia was also an example where then the government had to rethink of what they need to do. Simply by, you know, catching people is not solving the problem. Then you needed a health intervention. So the work that I'm doing actually is trying to convince the government by showing medical and health evidence that if you provide treatment for someone, then their chances for him to recover is much better than locking someone up in prisons. So this whole drug traffickers mandatory in 1983 was as a result of the war on drugs. See, this whole idea of when you use themes like this or slogans like this, it simply doesn't work, you know. It's to be seen very tough, war on drugs. ASEAN came up to say that they're going to be drug-free in 2015. This is another unrealistic goal because there's no country in the world that has been drug-free. So, but when you come up with slogans like this, you give these false expectations to society. And then people tend to say, hey, when are we going to become drug-free? It's not going to happen. You got to learn how to manage the problem. It's not going to go away. There's no way we're going to eliminate this problem. We got to manage it. And the way to manage it is to look at it from a health perspective. You know, this is where, you know, I'm trying to advocate from this perspective.
Thank you so much for that thorough explanation. Yeah, when I was hearing you talk about it, I recalled reading one of your papers earlier this week about decriminalization and whatnot, you know. So really the HIV thing kind of, I understood that point. I guess following up from that question, you know, since you mentioned that the HIV epidemic, you know, that was what caused the government to shift their view. And maybe this is this question maybe requires a lot more thought, but, you know, why is it so difficult for the government to kind of shift this health-based approach, you know, so difficult, you know, compared to what they did with the HIV thing back then?
Right, because it is, because these years of telling people it's a security threat, you know, it is very difficult to convince society in a particular community. If something goes missing, If a pair of shoes goes missing outside your house, the immediate thought is a drug addict came and stole it.
Yes.
And you would call the police and harass the police to say that you're not doing your job. And, you know, we often have dialogues with the police, you know. I think the police are also beginning to understand that, you know, keep sending them to prison, it's not working, they need something else. But this has been the mainstay of having this issue to be understood from a security point, you know, standpoint. And society is wired that way now to understand. So now to go and tell them there is a health problem, it does take time. It does require a lot of advocacy to make society understand. And, you know, and this health problem is actually related to also a social problem, a socio-environment problem, you know, because it is it's also related to behavior. You know, drug users tend to commit crime. I always say that, you know, even if you read in the media, they would say that this crime was committed and he was tested positive for drugs. So he's a drug addict, drug user, whatnot. But I always think that we should start changing the narrative to say that what if this guy probably created, committed this crime because he was not treated. Assuming if he would have provided treatment to this person, would he have committed that crime? So the media needs to also change its narrative in asking the, you know, to turn it around a bit. Otherwise, we keep, you know, reinforcing this stigma that becomes very difficult to undo.
Thank you. That's very, very insightful. Okay. So moving on now to just very general drug discussions and whatnot. First and foremost, you know, why might a person engage in drug activity?
Why someone gets... I mean, there's a range of reasons why people get involved with drugs. But from my experience working with drug users, is, you know, when you really start understanding and talking to them, it is the social environment that they grew up in, from families to poverty to living conditions. You know, when you start going down and really understanding the issues, then you would start thinking that have we as society not provided them enough opportunities, or even as a state, what has been a wrong policy that has resulted in this person becoming a drug user? I'll give you an example of, you know, why does drug use always happen in for example, low-cost flats?
You know,
because the built-up of the apartment or the, you know, it's like 500-600 square feet, and, you know, it's shown that even people from lower socioeconomic class tend to have bigger families, and bigger families with a smaller dwelling, right, smaller homes. And the child grows up most of the time outside the home, you know, and, you know, one thing leads to another, and then gets involved in drugs. So then you can, you know, ask, do we really have a right housing policy? So who do we blame here? Who do we point our fingers towards? Is it the state? You know, some countries, they look at the size of the family when they provide public housing, for example. We don't, you know, we provide this low-cost housing, and they're all very standard sizes, which are normally very small. And then you look at broken family, you look at education systems, and so on. You know, so there's a whole range of social factors that currently enforcement does not look at. Or when someone is sentenced, they don't really look at these issues very thoroughly. And there's no attempt to understand this. Even in the courts, I think if you read the, the lawyers normally would make a very simple, you know, saying that simple representation, because they would just say that he comes from a difficult family, or he's got three children to support this and that, but not going deep enough to try to understand the background of the individual. And this is what we're trying to even work with some legal folks, provide training and so on, so that they make a better representation for the judges to understand the real background from where these people have come from.
I see. So, like, it definitely stems more than individual needs, lah. I would say it's more of like a systemic issue in general,
exactly,
I think, to some
exactly.
extent. Right. Okay. Thank you so much for clarifying that. Yeah, so, you know, just once again, you know, reading some of your research, I think you did one recently, or not recently, in 2020, on cannabis news or something like that. I was just observing some of the data set that you took from your sample size. Do you think social economic factor kind of like is a common denominator among your drug users and whatnot? Like, maybe they come from much poorer backgrounds, or maybe they come from maybe upper class backgrounds where they're able to afford the drugs without much legal implications.
Yes, but generally it's from the lower social economic class. They are, of course, from the higher. There are certain drugs that are very expensive, but that's, you know, very exclusive. Very few cases that you'd find, but most of them are from the lower socioeconomic. And this is what I was talking about earlier, the whole range of issues that are, you know, it's a systemic problem that we need to improve or rectify for this, for the drug problem to reduce, you know. But just catching, putting people, you know, only this week I was having a discussion with the police and they're beginning to see where we are coming from. I said, you keep catching and putting them in prisons. They come out like 9 months, 1 year later. The following year, you're going to catch them again. So it looks like you're doing something that is redundant. You keep doing the same thing again all the time, you know, expecting different results.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you so much. So I think now moving on to one of the very last few sessions, basically on deterrence and public opinion, you know. So I think we know for the fact that the death penalty, you know, was used as an issue to tackle the issue of illegal supply of drugs. So in your opinion, do you think this would work in maybe deterring consumers from taking these drugs, you know, because the market supply is affected in a sense, and why?
Yeah, I think when we study in the area of drugs, there's always what we call demand reduction and supply reduction, basic economics. So supply reduction would be the area of enforcement agencies to reduce the supply. And demand reduction would be people who are in treatment and rehabilitation and prevention, in the area of prevention, drug prevention. So that should reduce the demand. So if demand is reduced substantially, then even if you have supply, supply will automatically reduce because they can't sell drugs because the demand is not there. So there is this equilibrium that we are trying to find. That's the theory behind it. You know, that's the academic part. But it is, in reality, very difficult to get that balance right. And, you know, again, from my experience of doing work in this area, any amount of drug seizures has never reduced supply. You know, for example, if you read in the papers today that in Kuala Lumpur, there were several tons of drugs seized, you would think that there's going to be a shortage of drug supply for drug users. And you go down to the street and you talk to drug users and you ask them, how is your supply? They say, no problem, you know. So enforcement or supply reduction has got its limited impact as well, you know. So any amount of seizures never reduces the supply on the streets. That means there's always some other people that is that's always trafficking drugs. For example, another good example to see would be if you understand the problem in Philippines. Remember when President Duterte took office, you know, maybe a decade ago, he said that when he comes to office, within a month, he's going to wipe out the drug problem and solve the drug problem. They went after shooting suspected drug traffickers. And then first month or 3 months, and he couldn't solve it. And then he asked for 1 year. And what happened? He still couldn't solve it simply because the issues there were poverty. You know, if people do not know where they're going to, you know, get money to put food on the, how they're going to put food on the table, you kill one sibling, the other guy, the other sibling is going to do the same thing. He's going to sell drugs because he needs to put food on the table. So the issue here was poverty and, you know, many other social environment, socio-environment problem. But here a leader came, thought that he can, you know, shoot people and, you know, get rid of the problem. He was not successful. Until today, he was not successful. You know, so that's always a very good example to understand that you can't just, you know, enforce. Even if you kill people, it's not going to solve the problem.
Exactly. Yeah. In fact, like, it's not even under the view of the law, to be honest. It's outside of the law. So it's a lot of human rights violations over there on that
end. That's right. Definitely. Yes.
Yeah. So I guess just looking back at Malaysia in general, you know, I mean, I'm not too sure what the public perception is of the death penalty in general. I think it can be assumed that even though the parliament's going to plan to abolish the mandatory death penalty, I'm not sure what public opinion is. But I guess the next question I have is, you know, why is our current public today still so amped that the death penalty is a proper deterrent for, you know, drug users and offenders? You know, why is it so difficult to change their opinion?
I'm not sure because, I mean, it's probably best they should answer this question. But I think it's this enforcement. Enforcement gives this sense of security, you know. I'm catching someone. You know, even in society, if the police comes and rounds up a few drug addicts, people feel safe. It has to be a slow, gradual process of making people understand that it's a health problem and they need to be helped and so on. So politicians or policymakers always seem to be doing something when they act tough. The intent of the policy is, you know, enforcing to go and tell people in society that we have arrested so many people, we have seized so much of drugs. It's always seen as providing this kind of comfort for people that the government is doing something. It's being tough on these people. But what we do not have is data on the impact of these drug traffickers that have been caught. Who are they, actually? You know, there's no study to show, and it's impossible to get this data. Some agencies or the government should actually, to design or to come up with good policies, we need evidence. It has to be based on evidence. But the evidence is not there until today. Since 83, we've hanged so many hundred or so many thousand people, but we do not understand who these people are. There needs to be an in-depth study to show that are we, hanging the right people or somewhere, someone who's really down the value chain, who's, poverty, and he came up, he had a difficult bringing and so on. One thing led to another and he became a drug trafficker. So this is something we need some studies. And to my knowledge, there's really no studies here to show. This is something that we should be asking the government to allow us to at least, really document these people who are currently in prison serving drug traffickers, to really understand their background, to go really deep down inside to understand their childhood, how they came up. And what led to this, that would then give us, then it will show us exactly how many of the real big fish who's really involved in drug trafficking are being hanged, or someone who's really a courier, who's, someone really low down the value chain. And, the real big fishes out there are really, they're not going to be touching the drugs, they're not going to be moving the drugs. It is the small guys out there who do it. And the issue here with the small guys is, do they even know what they're doing? Their education level is so low. I mean, look at what, the last few cases of this hanging in Singapore. You can see some of them are mentally challenged, some of them very low IQ, low education. So should we even be hanging this kind of, what use, what deterrent, what message are you sending when you're hanging someone like this?
Exactly.
This kind of studies, I'm really not sure why the government is not asking or commissioning someone to look at. We really would like to know the impact. Then we would be in a better position to answer the question of deterrence. That's my opinion.
Yeah, actually, I wholeheartedly agree with whatever you said, actually, So would you agree to a certain extent that, research and education, that would help the government in maybe resolving this systemic imbalances in our society to prevent, all these people from turning to drugs for income?
Yes, sure. This is what we try to do, is we continuously trying to do research. But again, research, our research, especially when you're coming to, incarcerated prisoners and so on, it's difficult to get access to do research with this kind of people. So we do research with other drug users and so on. The other challenge is, as academics, we do this type of research, we publish them in scientific journals and academic conferences. But again, it could be partly our fault for not disseminating this, writing this in a more simple way for public consumption. There needs to be more of that on the part of researchers and academics. At the same time, there should be also more engagement from the government with the research fraternity and even civil society to put out the evidence out there for people to actually understand. Because as part of my job, I'm not required to, you know, to engage with public. I mean, I am to some extent, but this is more of your own initiative. But how the university looks, you know, evaluates or assesses me is my academic writing in scientific journals. Right. So these are like technical stuff that you do. The society or the public out there wouldn't understand this fancy statistics that you do to try to, you know, to prove something. But this needs more to be translated, and, you know, there needs to be more dialogues with government agencies for them to be able to understand. And, of course, also on their part, to be able to accept the evidence that has been presented to them.
Yeah, definitely. So just relating, backtracking a little bit, you know, I think talking about cannabis in general, I think you've probably heard about the case of Dr. G and Luqman Mohamed, you know, from what we've heard, you know, since Kari Jamaluddin made that kind of announcement in Parliament, you know, saying that it's not actually, you know, illegal in a sense, you know, with correct, if people fulfill the right requirements, you know, do you think public opinion of, you know, marijuana will be set to change in Malaysia? You know, is that like a hopeful trend for it because of this growing acceptance?
I think there is a growing trend of acceptance. I mean, I've spoken to several politicians. They privately, you know, agree with what's going on. But of course, enforcement agencies would never. But I am, I think, of the view that medical marijuana should be allowed, you know. Maybe not the legalization part yet, but medical marijuana, especially for patients who have terminal illnesses, where there's really no other choice, you know, there's no modern medications available to treat. There's really no harm in providing medical marijuana to make the patient comfortable and so on. So, you know, in the case of Luqman, and I think he was helping, you know, of course, he's not a trained physician, but he was trying to do whatever within his means or understanding to help people so that in his mind or the objective of what he was doing was to help people, not to harm people or hurt people in any way. So I think the courts or even the government should view it from that point of view. You know, he was trying to help, genuinely trying to help people, because from his experience, he found that marijuana or cannabis could help people, especially those suffering from terminal illnesses. So that's the spirit that it should be looked at, rather than, you know, purely from an enforcement. Of course, the law would be, you know, if you just follow the law, then he's look at the why he was doing it. You know, he was not hurting anyone in any way.
Yeah, definitely. It's just, you know, reflecting on these two cases, you know, it's like, it makes you wonder, why is the death penalty being administered to people who have got pure intentions?
Yeah, because the law enforcement agencies would purely implement the law. Because the law says that they're going to implement it. It's just the government's, the enforcer of the law. When you talk to them, they say, we just enforce the law. That's our job. But it's the government that needs to say, wait a minute, you know, I think the law is like this. But, you know, in this case, I think there needs to be, you know, you need to really understand the law and the spirit of the law. What was the spirit of the law? You know,
yes.
He's not killing people. He's saving people, in fact, or making people's life a bit more comfortable.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. But, I mean, just cross fingers. We just hope that, you know, those cases turn out fine.
I hope good sense will prevail.
I hope so, too. Yeah, definitely. So, I guess my last question is, you know, would education on drugs help prevent further offences from occurring in the future? You know, making that greater awareness to allow maybe futures, like maybe small kids and stuff to come to informed decisions?
Yes, certainly. I think education plays a very important role. But then how we put out the message is also very important. If you keep putting out this message of security threat, and then you're sending the wrong message. You know, it is... and personally, when I've spoken to parents of drug users, when I make them understand from a health point of view, I tell them, you know, how continuous use of drug has damaged the brain and of your child, and how treatment can actually help repair that damaged brain, then there's a better acceptance from the parents compared to when they first would not understand this, and they would say that, you know, my kid is useless, he keeps... going back to drugs, you know, and so on. So, but, you know, then trying to make them understand from a health or medical point of view, then they actually can see that, oh, So they would ask you then and tell you that, oh, so you mean my son is sick? I said, yes, he is sick. He needs to be treated rather than be sent to jail all the time. And the fact that he's stealing from you or he's manipulating you for money and so on is because his brains is affected. Therefore, he's being manipulative and so on. You know, it's like someone who's got a psychological or a psychiatric problem and they behave strangely. Their behavior is affected as a result of their brains being affected by continuous use of drugs. So this needs to be addressed rather than incarcerating them. That's not going to help.
Yeah, I agree. So what do you think Malaysia could learn from the way other countries manage their drug policies?
I think we can learn from several Scandinavian countries who have done very well in managing. I think Malaysia is learning all the wrong things from Singapore, if I can say that. You know, our politicians sometimes go to regional meetings and tend to echo what the Singapore minister says. And I think we should not be looking at Singapore. They obviously have got it wrong in many fronts. And I think Singapore is smart because they're a small country. They are actually protecting their interests by acting very tough. Mm. And they can afford to do that because they're small. And, you know, export their problem to Malaysia, where Singaporeans can come to Malaysia and do whatever they want to do. But it's not going to work for us, the approach that Singapore takes. So I think we can learn lessons from several Scandinavian countries, several countries that have created diversion programs, like Portugal is a good model that can be understood, you know, how drug users can be diverted to treatment programs. With some form of sanctions, but the sanctions are designed to actually help them. So, so these are some of the things that we can learn.
I see. That's very insightful, I would say. I just got reminded by something actually in terms of your cannabis research as well. There was something to do with contradicting researchers based on like how if a country legalizes cannabis, basically there's a risk that there might be an upshot of addiction. You know, do you think this could possibly be an issue, or do you think decriminalization actually reduces addiction and whatnot?
I think the important thing is to understand that decriminalization and legalization are two different concepts. Yes. I think the concept of legalization, the impact of legalization of cannabis is not fully understood yet, because in US and Canada, it's still, sometimes this impact, you can't see it immediately. It will take some time, but definitely Malaysia is not there for legalization because the evidence is also not. It's kind of a bit mixed right now. And I said the impact is also very early to say. But, you know, continuous use of cannabis or heavy use of cannabis over a long term has got is also health consequences. So one has to be mindful of that. But on the other hand, medical use of marijuana may be, like I said, for terminal illnesses, I think Malaysia should seriously look at it because it has shown to help several patients, certain types of patients. And, you know, when everything else is not available or not effective anymore, there's really no harm in providing this. In a controlled environment, prescribed by medical practitioners, then I think you won't have a problem of misuse and abuse of cannabis. That would be my opinion at the moment.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing your opinion and answers and thoughts and everything in between for this entire discussion. So now what I'll be doing is I'll be opening a general question and answers. So for anybody who wants to ask Professor Vikna a question, you know, please feel free to put your hand up. There's a little small hut at the bottom where you can put your hands up to ask a question. I'll promote you to a speaker and you can ask. So yeah, does anybody have any questions? No questions? Okay, I think I will just ask a bunch of questions that I have on my end, if that's okay with you, Professor Victor.
Sure.
Oh, wait, I just got a request. Sorry, give me a moment, yeah? Okay, Ira? I think somebody had a question and requested. Ira, you can unmute to ask your question if you like.
Okay, Ira.
All right, hi,
we can hear you. Okay.
Hi, Professor. So I'm Ira from Redband. So I have a question for you. Your research focuses a lot on drug use and treatment barriers. So what are your current findings in terms of whether there are lack of treatment in Malaysia for drug addicts? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I think treatment is available, but what we are advocating is not... I think treatment for drug users should be provided in non-institutionalized centers. Or, for example, the government has many institutional rehabilitation centers, or what we call PUSPAN, in Malaysia. So these institutional rehabilitation centers, from the work that we have done, clearly shows that they are not effective. They're not only not effective, they're also very expensive because it's a 24/7 kind of facility where people stay in there. So the why we're saying it's not effective is you're keeping someone in an artificial environment. So someone behaves himself in an artificial environment. The moment they're out, they are going to be doing what they're doing or they were doing. The rehabilitation and the treatment component has got to address... The government's rehab program is a generic rehab program. They kind of provide the same form of treatment for all users. So for heroin users, it's okay because there is medication. But what is important... And then for amphetamine users, shabu, ice and all that, there is no medication available. So there's only psychosocial interventions. Similarly, even for heroin users, in addition to the medication, what you need to provide or what is extremely important is the psychosocial interventions, the counseling, the psychological interventions. Because like I said, the drug users, what I said earlier, the behavior of drug users need to be modified as well. So this is the weak link in the current treatment programs is the psychosocial components. You cannot give general counseling to all drug users because everyone comes or has a different problem. And, you know, so you need to address that. It needs to be very individualized, very focused towards individual needs. And so this is why we think that the issues with treatment, there continues to be very high relapse rate in the current treatment program. And they're also very expensive. For example, keeping someone in this PUSPAN or Pusat Seranti type of institutional program costs the government 38,000 ringgit a year per person. Whereas we have done some costing to show that if you treat someone in the community, which means he can be back home, he goes for his counseling to the clinics and for his medication and health checkups, it only costs the government 5,000 ringgit to have someone treated in the community. So these are just purely direct costs. The indirect cost would be much more where, for example, when someone can be treated in the community, he can also get a job. He's contributing to his family. He's living with his family. So all these are indirect costs that would, the savings would be far more substantial. And, you know, living in the community and getting treatment, you are there in real life. You are exposed to the cues and the attractions that would want you to go back to drugs. And then that's where the treatment provider can actually help address these concerns. But keeping someone in an artificial environment would not help. So these are some of the findings that we have, and we keep advocating with the government that, you know, spending much more money in just putting someone away is not going to be helpful. We need to provide treatment to them in the community itself, more like outpatient treatment rather than inpatient. Would be more helpful. Thank you.
Thank you so much for answering that question, Professor Vic, and thanks, Ira, for your question as well. Anybody else would like to ask a question? Okay, well, I guess I will ask one of the questions that I actually have. So, you know, just now you talked about the terminology between decriminalization and legalization, you know. Are there any other current issues, maybe perhaps in reframing current drug policies in Malaysia, which may be the reason why public perception isn't changing?
Say that again. Can you repeat the question?
Sorry. So, you know, just now you mentioned about how there are issues with the decriminalization and legalization terminology. So, you know, are there any other current issues when it comes to reframing drug policies in Malaysia?
When you say reframing drug policies, is it?
Yeah.
No, I think we would just like to see how the drug policy should be framed from a health perspective.
Okay.
Rather than from a social or a security standpoint. And I think this you know, if you look at in Malaysia, the high-level committees that are there by the government to manage the drug problem, they're all centered around the Ministry of Home Affairs. The secretariat towards all these high-level committees are Ministry of Home Affairs. So this Ministry of Home Affairs would largely have a very enforcement kind of perspective on things. So what we are saying is the Ministry of Health has to take a larger role in managing the drug problem in the country. You know, many people do not know this. The dangerous drug law, actually, it comes under the Ministry of Health, not under the Ministry of Home Affairs. The minister that's in charge of that law actually is the Minister of Health, not the Minister of Home Affairs. But the law is used mostly by the Minister of Home Affairs, Ministry of Home Affairs. Because all the classification of drugs, of what a dangerous drug is, comes under the Ministry of Health. So the owner of the law, if I were to use the word owner, the owner of the law is actually Minister of Health, not Minister of Home Affairs. But in real implementation, the Ministry of Home Affairs that implements the law.
I see. Yeah, I think I remember you said this earlier, so in our discussion. So apology if I made a little bit of repetition over there.
No problem.
Yeah. So I guess another question for me, you know, because like I said earlier, I remember you did cannabis research, you know, although it's a very small sample size, I'm aware. You know, are there any plans for you to maybe enlarging this sample size in the future to conduct more research?
Actually, I have not done a lot of research in cannabis, actually very little. I've done more work in Ketum research. But I've been looking at policies with regards to cannabis. I think there's certainly a group of researchers, I think in UPM, that have been looking at cannabis research and so on. But definitely, there is a lot of body of research already available because, you know, with legalization in Canada, US, and so on. So there's a lot of research studies that have already been ongoing out there to look at. So I guess we do not need to replicate much of it. Like I said, you know, I think medical cannabis, we can really seriously look at it, how it can help people. That would be something that we can look at. And I don't think that, you know, the research has been conducted extensively already abroad. So there may not be a need to conduct a lot more research here unless there's a health or a medical condition that has not been investigated before that we may want to look at.
I see. So could you probably say maybe in terms of maybe if we were to present this research to Parliament instead to legalize cannabis, maybe you would pull research from internationally as well, I would assume.
Yeah, I think that would be because they are, when you do one study, it may not be enough. But in research, what they do, they have review papers or they have meta-analysis that pulls together several studies and then looks at the strength of evidence from the several studies. So that gives you a better idea because it's not based on one study, but it's based on several studies from several countries. So it gives you a better sense of the evidence or the strength of the evidence.
I see. But might there be some fear that, you know, because technically speaking, we are on the eastern side of the world. So, you know, we're taking Western research. Won't a lot of people feel like, oh, you know, these are Western ideas, you know, it doesn't apply to us because we've got a different set of cultural ideas and whatnot?
Well, if you're looking at it from medical cannabis, then a disease is a disease, whether it's in the West or in the East. You know, a certain type of cancer would affect, there could be certain genetic variations, but generally a disease is a disease, would probably be, the disease profile would most likely be the same. So I don't see why we cannot take evidence from another country. I mean, if you're talking of a social problem, this and that, of course, then you've got to do, because there's cultural differences, socio-environment differences. Then you need to do it in our country to understand the issues, because they're going to be very different. But if it's a medical problem, then I don't see why we need to replicate another study here.
Yeah, so it's more of like a worldwide issue, I guess.
It's like with the vaccines for COVID right now. I don't think Malaysia has to test it, because there are enough studies conducted abroad, you know, to see its efficacy, and we just use our pharmaceutical regulators, just look at that data and see whether it's safe for us. You don't have to try it here again.
Yeah, that's true. So we've got 9 minutes left on the clock. I will take in any more questions that anybody else has to ask. Anybody? Okay, I will take it to mean that nobody's got any questions. I guess my last question for you is, you know, are there any other final thoughts that Professor, you'd like to share with the audience?
Well, I think we need to work together to shift our drug policy towards one thing is a health-based approach, and I think to need to understand that what we are doing, you know, people keeps, you know, we read in the papers almost every day that the drug problem, oh, we have a huge drug problem, but if we keep doing the same thing all the time and expecting something different to come up, it's not going to happen. And if we keep getting tough and arresting people and throwing people in prisons, you think it's going to just put the problem away temporarily. It's not going to solve or manage your problem in a better way. So I think more resources and our drug policy should be shifting towards a more health-based approach rather than an enforcement. You know, it's clear that, you know, you keep arresting people and putting people in prison, you're spending a lot more money with very poor outcomes. So I think there needs to be a lot more advocacy programs to make people understand that, you know, this is a health problem. There's enough scientific evidence to show that. But this shift needs to take place. It's going to be, you know, this to undo something that has been done for the last 30, 40 years. Society is wired into think in a particular way. Now to rewire that, it's not going to happen overnight. It's going to take time, but I think it has to start. I think all of us have a role to play in trying to, you know, make that shift happen.
So basically more public pressure, I suppose.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Professor Vikna, for taking the time today to basically, you know, have a conversation about drug use and the death penalty. You know, you're certainly very insightful, you know. But yeah, you know, so if anybody's got any more questions after this, you know, please feel free to maybe, you can DM Professor Vikna personally, or you can even pass it to Art Pan as well. We will relate the question back. Other than that, thank you so much for spending the afternoon with us, you know, discussing about all these matters. We'll close the room now. So yeah, thank you so much, everybody.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.